And now on RTE Radio 1, Arts Tonight with Vincent Woods.
On the programme, Literature, Landscape and Memory, an alternative literary atlas of Ireland. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. The late Professor Robert Welsh, who died earlier this year, wrote many fine books exploring aspects of Irish literature and landscape. Academic works like The Oxford Companion to Irish Literature and Irish Poetry from Moore to Yeats, and fiction and poetry, including The Kilcolman Notebook, provided significant insights into writing in Irish and English on this island and into the myriad landscapes, physical, social and linguistic, which inspire it. In the first Robert Welsh Memorial Lecture at Coleraine University recently, Professor Alan Titley of University College Cork proposed an alternative literary atlas of Ireland, inspired in part by Welsh's reading of place and literature and by his own acute observations on language, history and the tides of taste, power and persuasion that can raise some writers to fame and all but obliterate others. Alan Titley joins me now in studio to talk about his imaginary literary atlas and to remember the man who inspired it. Alan, Bob Welsh, a significant presence in Irish academia and Irish literature, and I suppose unusually he was a student and later professor of English who had a deep knowledge and love for Irish, and that informed so much of what he did.
It did indeed, and I think it probably grew from our background, because I was in school with Bob since we were in junior infants all the way up to the Leaving Cert together, and we were good pals, particularly in the latter years, because we were involved in debates and in plays and matters like that. But we were blessed with wonderful teachers, I think particularly in Irish and in English. And when Bob later went to University College Cork, I think his initial intention was to actually continue studying in Irish, and so he kind of had that choice. He was going to do one or the other. As it happens, he chose English and he went that road. He could just as well have gone the other one. And he always maintained an interest in both, and I think he saw Irish literature as a continuum and as all of a piece. I mean, going back to Frank O'Connor's great question in his own backward look, is Irish literature two things yoked together by a geographical accident, or is it one thing? And O'Connor, I think, answered in his own way. It's Irish literature is literature written by Irish people about Ireland. And that was Bob's idea as well. And he lived that, because not many people do on either side of that linguistic divide. There are very few professors of English, Declan Kybert would be a very good exception to that, who write in both and about both. And similarly, professors of Irish don't normally talk about Anglo-Irish literature, if we can call it that anymore, either.
What was that school in Cork, the secondary school that you both went to, where again you studied Latin, and I think that was significant too?
It was Colossi Christi, Christ the King Secondary School. Also, there were other interesting people who went through it since, but maybe we shouldn't mention some of them along the way. Micheál Martin, for one, was a person who was there. But it was, I suppose, we were just coming at the end of, we were the last class not to study a modern European language, because after us, they did French. Now, obviously, Latin continued for a few further years until the requirement was removed by the National University of Ireland. And, of course, Latin, because of its church connotations on one hand and because of classical connotation, the belief that was there that if you read the classics, you were a very learned person, and Latin was meant to be the basis for all other languages, which, of course, it wasn't. It was only for the Romance languages. But Latin was important. And Bob, you see, was very good at everything. And this was what was extraordinary about him. He would actually sit in the front row of this, since primary school, in the front desk on front of the teacher. Nobody passed any remark about that. And I remember when I was saying we had good English teachers, we had an English teacher, for example, who asked us to bring in and to read poetry that we'd written ourselves or that we read about. I remember Bob reading D.H. Lawrence's poetry, and he wrote an essay with the wonderful title of Thus Spoke Zara Motorcar. It was based on Nietzsche's great work. We were gobsmacked. I heard about Jack Kerouac from Bob Welsh. So he was reading everything, and he was also big into jazz. He was, a Charlie Parker. We didn't know who this guy was. But Bob was able to throw these things off in a very easy way. And he wasn't, I mean, he was obviously very studious, but he was also one of the lads. He hung around, and he did all the mad things that we did as well. And I think that was what's special. So in that school, we were encouraged. We had an Irish teacher, the Bard O'Hurdal, and again, a wonderful teacher. And he used to bring in the poetry of Sean O'Rear Dine every before he was on a course. And he would tell us you could meet him down in Liam Rushale's shop or his bookshop on a Saturday morning. He was off and down there. We thought all Irish poets were dead. And of course, he wasn't. And in that sense, yes, it was inspiring. But Latin was important. And I remember I liked Latin up to a point, but I really only got to like it in the last year. And it was, I remember reading through the Aeneid. The Aeneid was one of the books. You had 5 years of Latin and you were reading the Aeneid. And I remember saying to myself, this is a wonderful piece of writing. But of course, it was looked on as a grammatical exercise and translation exercise. But it was great poetry and was rarely done that way. But I think that had its influence on Bob as well, because he was ultimately a literary person. But he was good at maths, he was good at science, he was good at music. He knew them all. So, but I think ultimately he was pulled towards literature.
And of course, in being pulled towards literature, as well as writing significant academic books, and being a very, very respected English language academic in Ireland and in Britain and through Europe. He also wrote some very fine poetry and novels in Irish and English. You're going to read one poem of his, I think.
Yes, one short poem called Hope. I mean, he wrote, I think, five or six books of poetry, which is quite a lot. And being unusual, again, in the sense of a lot of academics are scared from writing fiction and writing poetry themselves, because it exposes them and it maybe catches them out a long way. But Bob wasn't afraid of that. So this is a simple poem called Hope. Hope is crossing the road, knowing that your friend is in, and that he'll ask you inside into the aroma of a different house. It is the calm stillness of the privet in the summer, when there's been no wind for weeks or rain and the leaves are dusty with thought. It is the dry earth beneath your hands, shaped into embankments, fortresses, continents, as the toy soldiers are drawn up and snipers strategically placed. It is the smell of rashers frying on a Saturday night, the walk home in expanding dusk, the smile of welcome you know you'll not forget.
The poem Hope by Bob Welsh there. Alan Titley, as with the central theme in your Alternative Literary Atlas of Ireland, the memorial lecture you gave for Bob Welsh, this idea of mapping Ireland through its literature. I suppose, you know, we've had books like the English poet P.J. Kavanagh's Voices in Ireland, this literary companion, and he was on this programme recently. But if we begin to do that at all, it's extraordinary how the landscape emerges and the richness and the diversity of Ireland comes alive through thinking of the literature and the writers through time.
Yes, I was thinking of it this way because, as I was saying, I think, for example, if you're a foodie, you like to spot that town as a wonderful restaurant. And, you know, if you're a sports person, you say that hurler or that footballer came from there. And being a kind of a bookish literary person myself, I would say, yes, that writer came from here. And what often struck me was the notion that in Ireland, this is where Bob Welsh comes into it, you know, you go to a foreign restaurant or you go see placemats of Irish writers, and they all start with Jonathan Swift. Now, there was 1,000 years or more of literature before Jonathan Swift. And my way of looking at it is there isn't a townland, there isn't a village they didn't have a local poet, and there isn't an area they didn't have a significant poet or writer. And the big places, for example, I was, if I may be anecdotal, I was doing a programme on the history of the Irish language for T.G. Cahir some years ago, and we went to visit Clonmacnoise. And a lady, and a very nice lady, said, oh, you're making this film about the Irish language, said we are. I said, but what had Clonmacnoise ever to do with Irish? One of the greatest books of Irish was written in Clonmacnoise, and we don't know these things. So when I go through all these various, when I go through Waterford, I think of Tyagelach, Suilvine, I walk to the Liberties, I think of Sean O'Nachton along the way, Cork City, Liam Inglis, who was a great poet just across from the English Market. They're everywhere. I go to Raftery in County Mayo, and indeed in County Galway, that whole strip of area around South Armagh, Louth, across to, you have Padraig, Derneen, you have, they're everywhere. And in that, to me, they were coming alive. And what I was afraid of is that if you had, I called it an alternative literary atlas, because I think if somebody was to kind of set out to do it, the first people you begin to think of would be Swift and Yeats and Joyce, and that's all very well. But there were a lot more. And I referenced a book which came out only a couple of years ago by a young scholar, Ciarán O'Conchianan, who tragically died shortly after that, which is about 700 or 800 pages. Only of the first line of songs collected in one small area of Galway. And you could replicate, in fact, it has been replicated in various other places as well. Any one area, it was full of songs. I'm not saying they were all great, it was great poetry, but everybody was composing and knowledgeable about this. And it wasn't an area without their storyteller. And we don't know that. So I'm thinking about this as something that would be educational, that people would come back and say, oh yes, we had these people here as well.
If you take an area like North Cork, an area that, again, Bob Welsh had close associations with, an area he loved, and Spencer there, you know, we think of Spencer, the Fairy Queen, and Bob wrote the Kilcolman Notebook, a fine novel drawing on Spencer's time and his, if you like, his interior life there. But you're also saying that when we take North Cork, and we have Elizabeth Bowen, Canon Sheehan, and others, but then you have a figure like the great 18th century poet Eoin Ruaidh O'Sullivan, and everywhere there is this underlying layer that informs all that was to come.
Yes, and I think I instanced Donnerail, or the North Cork area, is much more than Donnerail, because there's a Donnerail Literary Festival. And the two writers that are foregrounded or privileged, if you want to use that cliche, are Spencer and Elizabeth Bowen. And no problem with that, they were wonderful. I mean, Spencer was a marvellous poet. But he didn't exactly endear himself to the people of the area when he wanted most of them extirpated, and a lot of the Irish people along with that. And Elizabeth Bowen, again, a wonderfully subtle writer, but she didn't exactly muddy her hands with the normal goings on, and maybe she was right to do so. But it struck me that, you know, a poet like, as you said, Eoin Ruaidh O'Sullivan, who lived there, he wasn't from there, but he did a lot of his spalpeen work of his travelling labours. Sean Clorch MacDonald, who was another 18th century poet, and he was a Jacobite. He wrote Mihila Mar, which is a song which is still sung late at night usually by people, and other songs. He wrote a great satire on Dawson, who was a local landlord, which has been wonderfully translated by Michael Cody. I couldn't find it recently, but it's a brilliant translation by Michael Cody. But the point I was making about these writers was that they were not so much of the people, but the people took them on, so they sang their songs. Whereas I'm not sure how many people have read The Fairy Queen around Donnerail. I'd imagine not too many, whereas these were the songs that they sang. And the same would be true of everywhere, said everywhere around the country where these people lived. And for example, I mentioned Sligo, because Sligo is the Yeats County, which it is called in GA terms. I don't think Yeats knew anything whatsoever about Gaelic football or hurling, and wouldn't care less even if he did. But Yeats only lived a fraction of his life there, even though he dearly loved it and he's put it on the map. But Yeats is one of the greatest literary traditions in Ireland. There was a 16th century poet, Tadhg Dáil Ó Shin, who was a great bardic poet. I don't like the word bardic, but he wrote in classical Irish. And a friend of mine,
Sligo has this great tradition.
Sligo has this, and there was the Book of Ballymote, the Book of Lecan, and one of my own favourites, a guy called Murraigh Oliban Ó Chodála, or anglicised as Scottish Murray O'Daly, who was from Meath, probably educated in Cork, but we're not sure, but lived in Sligo, murdered a servant who came to collect taxes, had to flee from there, but he calls himself O'Daly from Drumcliff, O'Daly from Lissadell. He uses these places himself, and later on he had to flee the country. He went to live in Scotland, he went into Crusades, he came back later, he was a friend of Cathal Mór of the Wine Red Hand, of whom James Clarence Mangan wrote, and he went back to Scotland, at least my theory is he went back to Scotland, and he founded a poetical dynasty that lasted until the 19th century. They were Macvirich or Murray poets in Scotland down to the 19th century. He is an amazing, it is an amazing story. So I kind of, to me, they're as much part of Sligo as Yeats, and they wrote more about Sligo. You have the whole Ben Bulben story, one of the great Fenian stories, which we did in Leaving Cert Tóraíoch, the Yermid Agus Gráinne, the pursuit of Diarmuid and Gráinne. The final act of it takes place on the top of Ben Bulb. I'm not sure how they got up there, but it's kind of when Diarmuid is gored by a wild boar and Finn has magic water that he can give him to save his life, but because Diarmuid has run off with his lady, Gráinne, he lets the water sift through his hands and poor old Diarmuid dies. It's a great story, it's a great rollicking story as well. So Sligo is full of those, much more than that. And again, as I said, we don't know about these.
Alan, I want to listen to a little of that strange and haunting song, Carrickfergus. Song, of course, a huge part of the text of memory and history and place in this country, as we've been talking about. And then I want to talk to you about the possible origins of the words for the song.
I wish I had you in Carrickfergus, only 4 nights in Ballygran. I would swim over the deepest ocean, the deepest ocean, to be by your side. But the sea is wide and I can't swim over, and childhood days bring back sad reflection to happy times spent so long ago. My boyhood friends and my own passed on like the melting snow. But I'll spend my days in endless roaming. Soft as the grass, it is reported on marble stones as black as ink, with gold and silver I did support her, but I'll sing no more till I get a drink. I'm drunk today and I'm really sober. A handsome rover from town to town. Oh, but my days are numbered. So come all ye young men and lay me down.
Carrickfergus sung there by Van Morrison. Alan Titley, you remind us that Bob Welsh spotted a link between the song Carrickfergus and the writings of an 18th century Augustinian monk from Roscommon, Tomás Cassidy, or Tom Cassidy, who was quite a character.
He was quite a character, and this is one of the things that Bob did very well, because actually Carrickfergus is one of those weird songs, because when you listen to the words, it makes no sense whatsoever. One is about Carrickfergus, there's a verse about Kilkenny, there's another one about wandering the place, and the tune of Carrickfergus, I'm not sure when, I believe that it can't be traced back much farther than the Clancy brothers, somebody told me. Another person I heard said maybe it started at the beginning of the 20th century. But to me, it is linked to a song, the Vi Ban Wussel, which is a macaronic song, both in Irish and in English, which is largely comes from the Munster region, and a lot of the similar sentiments. And I think it must have been maybe the music put this into his head. And there are a lot of other songs about this Cassidy guy on Cashadach Bon, which is a Connemara song. And what Bob says in his companion is that it has echoes of another macaronic song, that is the Vi Ban Wussel, which seems to echo the story of this wandering monk, Cassidy, who had a fascinating life. It would appear that he was an Augustinian monk. He either had a love affair, or he says himself in the song, he married this woman, Posa Dunna Gan Viri, as he calls it, and he tried to do penance on Croagh Patrick. He left Ireland, he went to work, he joined the, I'm not sure if he joined, but he was fighting in the French army in one of the 18th century wars. He deserted the French army, joined the Prussian army. He tells us about that, deserted the Prussian army, had a row with a rabbi somewhere in Prague, chucked him over the bridge, came back, joined the British army for a while, only lasted a week with the British army, met some woman in England, stayed with her for a while, left her as well. He was a bit of a lad. He decided to come back to Ireland. He tried to reconcile himself, as far as we're aware, with the Augustinians, but we can't be sure of this, he joined a monastery, but he left that as well. And he spent the balance of his life, if you like, wandering the country, telling stories and singing songs. That seems to be the case. And Carrickfergus might well be one of the echoes out of that, because we don't know what the origin of it is. I read somewhere that both Dominic Behan and Dominic Behan claimed he had something to do with the writing. Peter O'Toole said he had something to do with writing. But it's a total nonsensical song, and it makes as much sense. But Bob spotted that, and it seems to me to make as much sense as anything else. So Cassidy would be a good, he'd be a good character in this. Atlas of Ireland, because of course he travelled the whole country.
We'll talk a little more about Roscommon and Roscommon literature and a new book in a moment. You're listening to Arts Tonight, my guest Professor Alan Titley, and back in a moment.
RTE Radio 1. No matter what life has thrown my way, I have always trusted my heart. For better or worse, it has been my guide. I followed it into the arms of the only man I ever loved. I have listened to and trusted its whisperings my whole life. But today, because I suffer from atrial fibrillation, it is betraying me, and I am having a stroke.
Atrial fibrillation is an irregular heart rhythm disorder, often without any obvious symptoms. Sufferers are 5 times more likely to have a stroke. Regular pulse checks can detect it. Visit irishheart.ie. Brought to you by the Irish Heart Foundation, proudly supported by Pfizer.
NSAI's Excellence Through People certification has made a real difference to our business.
Mark Rogers, Head of Human Resources at Danone Baby Nutrition Operations, talks about the NSAI.
We believe in fostering the very highest standards among our 300-strong workforce in our manufacturing plants. NSAI certification is not just independent proof of those standards. We have also found that it motivates our staff and improves productivity. I would strongly recommend Excellence Through People to other businesses.
To find out more, visit nsai.ie or call 01 807 3800.
Our guest on Arts Tonight, Professor Alan Titley, who recently gave the first Robert Welsh Memorial Lecture in Coleraine University, outlining the basis for an alternative literary atlas of Ireland. Alan, we're talking about Roscommon there a little while ago, and that brings us to this book just recently published, the Roscommon Anthology, a celebration of Roscommon's writers, edited by Michael and John O'Dea. A very interesting example of a book, as was trying to place literature in a specific locality, and includes people like Douglas High, John Waters, Brian Leyden, Hannah Greely, Sean and Yachtan. A rich selection, and I think you'd agree, a useful one.
It is. I think the idea of local collections is a very, very good one, because it gives people a sense of their own place, and people are quite proud of their own places. And again, they don't very often know what's going on or what has gone on very often. And the good thing about this anthology, it has both contemporary writers and historical writers as well. And as we know, cultural tourism is very important. I'm not sure how much of this goes on in Roscommon, but there is the basis of, I mean, you have summer schools dedicated to writers all over the country. And this kind of a book will actually maybe put this idea into somebody's head that here there were significant writers. There was Oliver Goldsmith, of course, there was John McGahern, who lived there. Percy French, whom I hadn't associated with the place, although I noticed the poems from Percy French, they haven't got to do with Roscommon, the Mountains of Mourne and Come Back Paddy Riley. Of course, Percy French wandered the country and wrote about all these various places. Well, but it's a very wise collection so far as they take people who were born in Roscommon or who lived for a while in Roscommon or who were there for a while and left and so on. So it's quite, if you like, broad-minded in that sense.
You get something like David Thompson's Woodbrook as well.
David Thompson's Woodbrook, again, which is a memorable book I read a long time ago, is a wonderful one. And you mentioned Sean O'Nachton, who came to live in Dublin in Pimlico and was a friend of Dean Swift's, who would appear. And Dean Swift, we were fairly sure, composed some of his poetry based on, and may have, Sean O'Nachton may well have translated for him. So there's all kinds of people here. And I noticed, for example, that, and I'm delighted to see Thorlach O'Carolan is here, because we associate Carolan entirely as being a harpist because of Carolan's Concerto and Sívheog Sívheor and the great work that Sean O'Riordan did in reviving Carolan's music, if you like. But Carolan was, as, and most people would remember Carolan if they remember the Irish £50 note. If you had one in your pocket long enough to recognise who was on it, it was Thorlach O'Carolan, and there you had the harp in the background and so on. But Carolan was also a poet, and he often sang his own poetry to the harp accompaniment, which was probably something quite unusual. I wouldn't be sure of that, but I think a lot of Irish traditional singing, because they didn't have instruments, is unaccompanied, as we know. But there's no reason why it couldn't have been accompanied with the harp. And although the great harpist Belfast's festival at the end of the 18th century, as far as I know, they were just, even though there were words involved, they just took down the music. But Carolan maintained that tradition, and he was writing in it. I don't think he was a great poet himself, but he was a good poet, and he wrote an awful lot. I mean, there is a Irish Text Society book which runs to several hundred pages with Carolan's poetry in it. And so this poetry was, we often associate the Irish Gaelic tradition with poverty. This was the poetry that was being sung in the big houses of, you know, the MacDermots and whoever else was around the Roscommon and Cavan and Meath areas, because that's where he was.
You're going to read one of his poems.
Yes, there's a poem in this anthology, Cupan Cian O'Hara. So it's the Cup of Cian O'Hara. O'Hara must have been, I'm presuming, one of the landlords, and he is celebrating how great this cup was. And he liked to be in this man's place drinking out of his special cup. So it's quite a short poem, simply praising the drink in his place. Cupan Cian O'Hara. Da meng hir an oren, nu a garlin a shead, Marung luishingach sorlung de chlareadus maid. Barlum gan auras mar hosagum fain, copan galli aira, vel live le mevail. Gade boildum ta chorigail, as a licht a ma na yeg, is gorabedir olive nemreag, darma lifesha, ni breag. Terelach vrien avil, tarig tra fam yen, gan nolum as an tar chopan, slainte vre chain. So he is drinking the health of this guy who looked after him for quite a while. Thank you.
The Chieftains there with Carolyn's Concerto, and before that the words of Thurlacle Carolyn from the Roscommon Anthology, edited by Michael and John O'Dea. Well, we visited King House in Boyle in County Roscommon last week for the launch of the Roscommon Anthology, and I spoke to the editors. First, Michael O'Dea.
My mother died in 2005, and that kind of cut my connection with Roscommon completely. So I thought, I am a poet, I have a couple of collections of poetry so far, what can I do to keep my connections? And this is what I decided to do. I knew there was a pool of fine Roscommon writers. I didn't realise how deep that pool was at the time, but certainly there was enough there to produce a book. Afterwards, then I found that there was more than enough there for a very fine book.
John, the book, when you went looking again at the landscape and the literary landscape of Roscommon, were you surprised at how much there was there?
Well, I was absolutely stunned because my memory of kind of Roscommon was more high kings and castles and abbeys, and one or two obvious ones like Percy French and Douglas Hyde. And I just couldn't believe the kind of... I love the idea of Own the Gat in Rathcrohan, that you had this subterranean literary thing going on in Roscommon, a county where people just pass through without thinking. And I just think it's such a rich gift for Roscommon, this book.
There's also a literary map of Roscommon, which is a very striking piece of artwork in itself. Tell me about that.
We just came up with the idea that the project would be bigger than just a book, that we would like Roscommon to honour its heritage by maybe involving the county council in identifying where people like Oscar Wilde's father, Goldsmith, John McGarren, Thurlacle Carolyn, where they came from. You know, and that the people in Roscommon would appreciate it, but also the people in Ireland, because Mary McAleese recognised the value in the book by writing the foreword, and she made the point that this book is not just a work for Roscommon, it's an important work for Ireland, because it kind of weaves in the literary heritage of Roscommon into the literary landscape of Ireland.
Brian Layden, what does it mean to you to be in this Roscommon anthology?
Oh, I think this is a fantastic achievement, and fair play to the editors. County publications that kind of establish and copper fasten an identity for the place, they're rare enough, really. And when you get sort of ambitious editors like we have here, who are going to take in the likes of John McGarren and Percy French, so you have the living and the dead.
And of course there's a map as part of the book, this new literary trail, and Brian Layden is part of that map now.
Well, you see, this is brilliant for writers who, obviously, if you've any connection with Roscommon, you're going to be in the shadow of John McGarren. And if people hear the name Arigna, he's borrowed a few of, indeed, your own locations and mine, Vincent. So the fact that actually can people place territories now, and Arigna is quite distinct from the plains of Boyle and Gloria Bog, and there's Hardy's Wessex and there's all of that. So why not writers claim their patch?
John Waters, do you still have a strong sense of an attachment to Roscommon?
Oh, I do. I mean, I'll always be from Roscommon, no getting out of that. I used to come down here very regularly until a year ago. My mother died about a year ago, and I find myself slightly bypassing it in recent months. I go to Sligo, where my father is from, more often than not. But yeah, I'll always have this attachment. It'll always be part of what I am, I suppose. And the piece in the book, Driving at the Crossroads, is sort of lodged in this part of the country.
The piece in the book from Driving at the Crossroads is this lovely piece remembering your father, the Democratic God, the title of it, and the beautiful memory of the gramophone and the songs of John, the voice of John McCormick or Bridie Gallagher coming out through the machine.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, my father used to have these. We didn't have a radio or TV or any of that stuff, but we had several gramophones, and occasionally one of them would, my father would get it working and wind it up, and it would work for a little time, and it was an extraordinarily miraculous thing. He had that sense of, it's almost impossible to imagine now, of being a great lover of machines, but needing to have a sense of mastery over them. He preferred them when they were just a tiny fraction short of disintegration, so that he could be in control of their life. And so all the machines, including vans and cars, were just a little bit away from the edge of complete obsolescence. And he used to kind of pull them back and hold them there for a little while, and then they would slip again.
Michael, I suppose one of my distinct memories of country life is old men and not so old men outside Mass on a Sunday, having a chat after religion. And you have a lovely poem in the book called The After Mass Men, which you might read for us.
Remember those figures by the church wall, sculpted in aftermath conversations, bladder-tattooed men that hung there by their jackets, museums with pockets, pockets full of knives, pipes and matches. Stone men, pre-Christians defiling Sabbaths with their Saturday conversations, gargoyles. Coats would be wrapped against them as though they were sudden showers of hail.
An enthusiastic response there in King House in Boyle in Roscommon for Cathy Jordan of Dervish at the launching of the Roscommon Anthology. Alan Titley, I suppose people who love writing and books and poetry and music will have their own particular associations of place with author or book. And we talked about some of this, you know, I suppose Frank O'Connor and Cork, Joyce and Dublin and Marie Edgeworth and Longford and so on. But if we take a bigger view, I suppose a literary... an alternative literary atlas of Ireland might also extend beyond the shores of this country at all. I'm thinking of the Australian poet Vincent Buckley writing about how the Irish live without a key in a superbly coded land. And I suppose Irish literature has reached out to Australia, to the United States, to so many places that if we were to begin to create an atlas, I suspect it would blur the borders of this country too.
Oh, it would, and I think it should be. I mean, the diaspora has become much more important because we continue to feed diaspora for good or for ill all the time, and it certainly would. And I mean, again, you can go back as far as you like, starting off with, I suppose, the early Irish monks who travelled to Europe in the 7th and 8th and 9th centuries. And we can be quite cynical about ourselves when people speak about the island of saints and scholars, but it actually was true. We did send many, many missionaries who created, who kept the light of culture alive in Europe for a long time. But the interesting thing is, a lot of the early Irish lyrics that we have, like the great poem in Pangor Bawn, they were written down at the margins of manuscripts in places like Bobbio and in Prague and in Sangall in Switzerland. And so, you know, that is not an exaggeration. And you can go on, the guy I mentioned earlier, my Scottish Murray O'Daly, he was all over the continent. We have bardic poems from the Mediterranean area. But when you come to more recent times, you have all the American diaspora, of course, and you have the English diaspora, Patrick McGill, both in Scotland and in England. Although sometimes it does strike me that given the amount of emigration, I don't think we have that much from Britain compared with what we should have. I mean, I think you could again put an anthology together of those, it would be interesting. But if you consider the hundreds, indeed millions of people who went to England, and a great deal of that voice is silent. The navvies, I mean, we have Donal MacAulay's great books on that, but there's precious little else. There's certain amount of the Scottish Tatey Hawkers and so on. I'd have expected more. And but I think what's happening today is that, with Colin McCann in the United States, I suppose Frank McCourt, if you're from a slightly earlier time, although he was writing much more about Ireland, even indeed about Limerick, than he was about the United States, but that is now part of the Irish diaspora. And of course, with things like the Booker Prize opening up and Irish writers are getting involved in that. So yes, it would take, and I've no doubt that in future years, if that was to be done, these should be included. And I've no doubt we will uncover work from people who went to live in strange places that hasn't come to light yet, because there's an awful lot of stuff, to use the phrase, out there that hasn't come to light.
And that's the point, isn't it? This is not a static landscape either in Ireland or internationally. You know, if we look forward, even, you know, we're in this decade of anniversaries and World War One among them, and we talked to this program recently about, you know, suppose the part that art and literature can play in remembering and sometimes questioning the past. And, you know, this again, this idea that an alternative literary atlas would certainly cast light on the past, but it is this evolving picture. You know, if you think of Kevin Barry's City of Bochane or Kieran Carson's Belfast or Rita Ann Higgins' Galway, this is a constantly evolving, constantly changing landscape.
Well, yeah, there are new writers coming to the fore all the time. And as you mentioned, Kevin Barry's wonderful in City of Bahain, which we're not sure. We think we have an idea where it is, because I think it's a mixture of a few cities, actually. But you could also have an imaginary literary atlas of Ireland where all these places, these fantastic places that people have made up, and that would be a kind of a Hobbit Ireland, if you like. That would be an entirely different one as well. But yes, it is, I suppose, it never surprises one that there are, maybe, sorry, it always surprises one, and it shouldn't, that there are new writers coming to the fore out of nowhere all the time. And of course, there are people who show promise and nothing happens to them. Then there are people who are writing away and have manuscripts and drawers, and they come to the fore all of a sudden. That is always going to be the way. I often worry, I don't worry, but with the working until recently in universities and working in universities and colleges all my life, and we know that the arts are under pressure from economics and from the sciences and from business and all that stuff, which of course I have no problem with that. I mean, we need these people maybe a lot more than we need writers, but people kind of say the arts are undervalued, and in a sense they are, but I don't think we should ever have to apologise for the arts. The arts are there because they're one of the most human things we can do. And I would say it's always interesting that mothers and fathers with their young children, they buy them books and they tell them stories. And then come to the age of 13 or 14, they kind of say, maybe not quite openly, but you get the impression, put away all that childish stuff and now get into the real world. But why do we tell them stories when they're 2 and 3 and 4 and 5? Because we know they're important. Because stories and poetry, indeed, they give us a framework for the world. And as we go on, people will always do that. Again, no more than not being a town or village without as poet, there isn't a culture, there isn't a language, there isn't a country, there isn't an area that doesn't have its writers and its songsters and its people. And it was always the case, and it will always. You don't have to apologise, you don't have to be wary of it. People will do this because they have to.
I'm just thinking that if we were to imagine an atlas with some of the imaginary places, where would we locate Chearnan Oak?
Yes, probably everywhere.
It's the fifth province in our memory, isn't it? It's the heart of it all. Mentioning song again, you know, I can't resist playing one song that you referenced in your lecture. That's Salonika, the great song from the First World War, and I suppose something of an anthem of Cork. And here's Jimmy Crowley's inimitable version of it.
My husband's in Salonika, and I wonder if he's dead. I wonder if he knows he has a kid with a foxy head. So right away, so right away, so right away, Salonika, right away, me soldier boy. Now when the war is over, what will the slackers do? They'll be all around the soldiers for the loan of a bob or two. So right away, so right away. So right away, Salonika, right away, me soldier by. But when the war is over, what will the soldiers do? They'll be walking around with a leg and a half, and the slackers we'll have too. So right away, so right away. So right away, Salonika, right away, me soldier by. And the taxter pound the butter, the taxter halfpenny bun, but still with all the taxes they can bait a bloody hun. So right away, so right away, so right away, Salonika, right away, me soldier by. And the taxed old Coliseum, and the tax in Mary's Hall, why don't they tax the bobbies with their backs to gim the wall? So right away, so right away, so right away, Salonika, right away, me soldier by. But when the war is over, what will the slackers do? For every kid in America, in Cork there will be two. So right away, so right away, sir, right away, Salonika, right away, be soldier by. For they takes us out to Blarney, they lays us on the grass, they puts us in the family way and lends us on their arse. Sir, right away, sir, right away, sir, right away, Salonika, right away, be soldier by. There's Lino in the parlour and in the kitchen too, at last back chiffonera that we got from Dickie Lou. Sir, right away, sir, right away, sir, right away, Salonika, right away, me soldier by. And before that I got married, sure I used to wear a shawl, but now the war is over, it's hanging in Jones's pond. Sir, right away, sir, right away, sir, right away, Salonika, right away, me soldier by. And never marry a soldier, a sailor or a marine, but keep your eye on the Sinn Féin by with his yellow, white and green. Sir, right away, sir, right away, sir, right away, Salonika, right away, me soldier by.
Jimmy Crowley there with Salonika. Alan Titley, a great, great song from your city.
It is a great song, and I think it's a much better song than The Banks of My Own Love Lily. I think, in fact, all those GA songs are terrible, almost without exception. Maybe The Mountains of Mourn, because the words are clever, but, I mean, The Rosamund Coyne and The Awful Sliabh na Mban and Limerick You're a Lady of the Night, sometimes I add to it along the way. They're all terrible. I think they're terrible songs. And The Banks is not a great song either. It's mournful and maudlin and sloppy and gungy. But Salonika is a great song because I think it's a great reflection of what went on at the time of the First World War. Some people went off to fight and the others stayed at home, maybe not often for patriotic reasons, because they didn't care. I mean, those lines in it about when the war is over, what will the slackers do? They'll be all around the soldiers for a loan of a bob or two. But then the next one, when the war is over, what will the soldiers do? They'll be hobbling around in a leg and a half, but the slackers, they'll have two. So it's an anti-war song in its own way, but also an anti-war song is we're staying here and enjoying ourselves while you people, Egypts in there, are away there. And so it tells you a lot about Cork, but I think a lot about the Irish mentality. And I suppose as well, having fun with something that was very serious, which is something we're very good at.
And I suppose, again, that is a part of, you know, of literature. It's the voice of the people. Here's a testimony to something very, very significant that's happening internationally, but it's reduced to its essence in a similar way to something like Johnny, I Hardly Knew You.
Yes, I think we shouldn't easily make the distinction between poetry and song. Again, in the Irish Gaelic tradition, poetry and song for a long time were coterminous. They were more or less the same thing, not entirely, but very often they were. And a great deal of the ballads that we hear, they're great poetry as well. And that's true in all languages. And I think it's a great test of a ballad, whether it can be sung or not. If it can be sung, it's much more likely to survive. And the ballads come from the ordinary people. I mean, the greatest author of all time, everywhere, is a person called Anonymous. And Anonymous has written so much, because what happens is somebody writes a song and it is taken on and people then sing it and recreate it. And again, they make their own. Very often a song will change over time. And I've known people with Salonika adding verses to it and getting rid of verses and putting their own bits in. And you could make it just contemporary. But it is the people's poetry, as it should be.
I have to ask you about the sex change of the Abbot of Drimna, one of the earliest stories about Dublin written in Irish. When was it written, and do we know who wrote it?
We don't, because we don't know who wrote the early stories at all, but we must presume it was probably a monk, or probably a because the monks were the only literate people anyway, the only people who could read or write. But yeah, it's a story, so it's 7th or 8th century, I suppose, 8th or 9th century anyway, because you can't put a precise date on these. But it's to do with the Abbot of Drimna, who is he is travelling over to an adjacent monastery, and on his way a mist descends on him, and magically he is transformed into a woman. When he wakes up, he notices that some of his equipment is missing, so to speak, and he has been transformed into a woman. And later on, I think he reverts along the way. But I was throwing this in because, again, we don't often associate Dublin with the Irish language. But of course, all these abbeys around, like Finglas and Talla, they were all centres of learning. They weren't just centres of holiness. In fact, they may have been more centres of learning than they were centres of loneliness, of holiness along the way. And of course, I keep saying, when the Vikings turned up, it took them months to conquer Dublin. There were people here already, you know, we often forget that. And these were the Irish, this is what they were writing about. So it's a great story, not often mentioned because it wouldn't have been one that I suppose early puritanical 20th century Ireland would have been too fond of, but it is there nonetheless.
So the literary atlas encompasses everything, all human life. You say that Irish literature is one of the great literatures of the world, and in its length, depth, breadth and vision is one of this country's greatest achievements. How strong, how healthy is writing in Irish these times? Are there enough talented young writers in Irish coming up to sustain that great tradition?
There are, and again, this is one of those surprising things. You feel that there's a gap and nobody's coming along for a while. Obviously, I grew up at much the same time as what we're called the Inta poets, even though I'm not a poet. Well, I have written poetry, but I'm not primarily a poet. But, you know, they were the young guns at the time. Michael David, Gabriel Rostock, Nolan Nihon, Liam and Witherland. They did a great deal of good. And then there were some other people came after. It was a bit of a hiatus. But actually, in the last 5-6 years, there's a complete new bunch of people. There's actually an organisation called Scríbhneoirí Uaire na Gaeilge, the young Irish writers, and most of them are poets, I should say, which doesn't make me always happy. I mean, I love poetry, but I think poetry is only one part of literature. But then very often people may eventually write prose as well, but they are there. I mean, Catriona Ní Chéirín, Alva Ní Yarrahuí, Aoife McCaid, you know, there's a whole gang of them, Rian Ní Chonáil. They're all writing children's literature, writing stories, writing poetry. So yes, it is there, and it will always be there. I remember looking at the table of contents for a conference in Galway early this year, and I hardly recognised anybody. It was an Irish language, Irish literary conference. So there's young scholars and young writers coming to the fore all the time. And again, I'm not despondent about that, because I think it is here. Obviously, the Irish language has been in a perilous state for quite a long time, but we've been saying this since the 17th century, and we're still here, and we're going to be here, and I think people should get used to that and kind of factor it into what's going on. And not, I mean, you can be despondent as you like, and good reason to be very often, but there will always be new people coming to the fore.
Before we finish, you're going to read a piece from one of Bob Welch's essays, which again, I suppose, goes to the heart of a great deal of what he was about in his work.
Yeah, one of the things Bob did very, very well was he was able to take the big long view, because he did this with his Oxford Companion, and he did it with a lot of his big books, I mean, History of the Abbey Theatre. But he was able to look back, because he had both languages, he was able to look back and say, right, this is what was going on. And in one of his, a great collection of essays, Changing States, Transformations of Modern Irish Writing, in the first essay he's trying to look back and say, what happened to us? What happened in the 19th century? So he takes it in more or less, not so much what happened, what didn't happen. In what way was Ireland different? So it goes a bit like this. We are dealing in Ireland's case with an example of an almost completely successful colonial takeover. There was no settled body of Irish life and thought in a modern, secular, urbanised and predominantly middle-class sense in which that phrase tends to be applied. When we use it, we think of the established norms of polite society, of theatres, perfume, salons, cafes, its business and its art, its eating and its drinking, Moll Flanders interiors, Zola's kitchens and drawing rooms. We think of newspapers, of publishing industry, authorship, artists and their modern dependence upon and conflict with materialistic society. We think of parliaments and courts, of the power language may have in these environs to persuade, affect, deceive and stultify. All of this large arena of modern European culture, so dependent on the way language creates and reflects society, is to a great extent absent from Irish life up to the 19th century.
The words of the late Robert Welch. Alan Titley, a beautiful phrase you used in your lecture. You said there's hardly a townland or a parish without the golden shadow of an Irish poet, storyteller or balladeer. And the golden shadow made me think of Bob Welch himself and the brightness that people like him leave behind, like the great, as was the great golden light of Seamus Heaney.
Yes, I think, you know, somebody like Bob, and as we know, Seamus, are a terrible loss to Irish letters in the broader sense, because Bob was, as I said, different because he had both languages and he worked on both of them together. He also saw the big picture. He was also interested in everything because he wrote poetry and fiction, wrote about poetry and fiction. He wrote plays and he wrote about plays as well. So there wasn't a corner of Irish literature that he didn't touch. And I do know, for example, in that Oxford Companion, because I spoke to him about this at one stage. Now, lots of people were involved in writing little bits of essays. I may have done one or two myself. But I do know that Bob probably wrote the greater part of it, because as anybody who's ever tried to edit anything knows, you end up writing a great deal of it yourself because people inevitably let you down, or indeed you have to correct other people's mistakes. Because I remember asking him, where did you get that? And he would say, oh, I did that myself, with a kind of a twinkle in his eye. So he is a tremendous loss to some of us, a personal loss of course, but I think great loss to Irish academia as well.
Alan Titley, thank you very much indeed. And Alan Titley is Emeritus Professor of Modern Irish at University College Cork. The Roscommon Anthology is published by the Roscommon Literary Heritage Group. Full details on the roscommonanthology.com. Next week, Doris Lessing, the novelist who helped change the shape of modern literature. Join us next Monday at 10. Till then, good night.